If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret. Searching for the sound. This is The Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman.
Your eyes. You've been listening to Shadows from the Kitchen Dwellers' latest release, Muir Maid. The Kitchen Dwellers are on the rise and are quickly becoming a staple on the bluegrass scene and within the larger jam band community. They recently released a new record that they funded with a highly successful Kickstarter campaign. In fact, they invited Chris Pandolfi of the infamous String Dusters to produce this record. It's a solid effort, so we tracked down mandolinist Sean Swain to talk about the record, its songs, and much more. Our conversation started when I asked Sean what prompted the Kickstarter campaign.
It just kind of came down to the fact that we wanted this one to be a release on a larger scale than we'd previously done. And when you want to do something like that at a kind of a lower mid-level band, we don't have a whole lot of capital, and we don't have a record label who's just giving us, the money up front to record this stuff. So we wanted to bring out the best product we could for our fans. So we reached out and asked them for help, and everybody came together, and we're pretty stoked on the way that went. But basically, that was because things are extremely expensive for bands these days, and it's definitely a hard world to make it. And with the decline of the power of the record labels and stuff, it's almost a necessary thing for a band at our level to do to get the funding in order to put that kind of product out there.
You have your whole life to make your first record, and then the second record kind of is a hurry up sort of thing. Ghost in a Bottle came out in 2017, and here we are already in 2019, a year and a half, maybe two, from Ghost in the Bottle. Was it difficult to get things together for this record in terms of songs and having enough material to put out a second record?
Oh, definitely not. By the time we had finished Ghost, a lot of these songs were already in the breadbasket. Being worked on, being cooked up. So it kind of just flowed naturally. When we recorded Ghost in the Bottle, all of those songs we had been playing for years leading up to that point. So naturally, with the passage of time, we'd had enough time to come up with a whole nother batch of songs pretty easily in that time. And this was also the first album where all four members of the band have songs that they have written that appear on the record.
I think the last record, if I'm not mistaken, was produced by Andy Thorne. Why did you decide to get Chris Pandolfi from the Dusters involved in this record?
Well, it all started kind of, I saw this this article on a webzine somewhere that Chris had written a few years ago about how basically that there's this kind of nose way up in the air attitude around bluegrass and what bluegrass is and what's accepted as bluegrass. And he just kind of thought that was all, horse hockey. And he clearly in his writing had shown that he was really open to the progression of newer, cooler, weirder, further out sounds and the whole exploration for it. And I was like, shit, man, that kind of sounds exactly like what we're doing. And I reached out to him, and after a brief discussion, we decided that we had a pretty similar vision on what we wanted to do is with a record, as far as him producing one and us creating one. And it just kind of was very smooth process from there. To working with Chris is unbelievable.
How so?
Well, he's this energy and knowledge that comes off of him is unlike anybody, other musician or any person I've ever really spent time with. And he's incredibly trained, right? He's gone to Berkeley. He's got, graduate degrees in banjo and stuff like this. And we don't have any of that in this band. We're a lot of self-taught with very minimal training, with the exception of Joe. And what Chris is able to do is basically take his place as a much more elitely trained musician and put his mind where we are and can put ourselves in our shoes and help us to guide us to a place that we actually didn't quite know we were capable of reaching, probably.
A good coach, a good mentor, for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you send him demos of songs, or was it a case of you just wanting to get together in the studio and work some of these songs out with him in person? How did that go down?
Well, what happened, you know, after I first approached him and asked if he'd be interested in producing this album, we actually got together at his house in Denver probably close to a year before, you know, 9 months, maybe 6 months before we recorded the album, and we played to him all of these songs. And for a few days, he sat down with us and we kind of worked through each song step by step. And we're like, this is, you know, and he helped us, you know, with the direction, creative direction is, and mentorship on that. And then we played those songs that way for the next several months and let them evolve from there to the point when we actually hit the studio. We had, in most cases, the songs had grown quite a bit since we had all initially met up.
So you brought him a bunch of songs. Like, were there songs that didn't quite make Muir Maid that are left on the cutting room floor, so to speak?
Everything that we brought to the table made it on the album, and we even added one or two.
That's awesome. Let's talk a bit about some of the songs on the record, because it's a collection of great work. I'm curious, though, before we get into it, was it about honing your sound, about getting more familiar with each other? I know that you're on the road a lot, but the studio is a very different place. And when these songs have to sort of come alive to tape, it is about working together. And even if you're on the road and playing a ton together, you're not necessarily, you know, on the same wavelength. Did Chris or did you guys decide that was really important for this record? Because it really does flow from the first track to the rest of the record.
Well, I think a lot of that happened naturally. You know, when we decided we were going to make another record, there wasn't any really goal and like, we're going to make this better than the last one, or we're going to, you know, show that we've grown in this way or another compared to the last one. We just kind of needed another record out there. And in all honesty, really just to stay relevant in this quickly growing scene and expanding scene. But it was through the studio process. I think the band definitely grew a lot as players and as people. This is the first record we ever did where everything just went completely smoothly. Even a couple of the tracks on the album, I think definitely one, maybe two, were even done in just one live take.
Wow.
And that never happened before. And I think that's a lot of that as a result of, you know, we've been playing like 200 shows a year for the last several years. I'd like to believe we're playing pretty tightly. And, you know, also the direction of Chris being like, he's like, all right, that was good, we can move on. You know, that helps too, because it's pretty easy to get stuck in your own head and do a song 50 times when really sometimes it's not even about what the cleanest or most perfect sounding one is more about the energy. And I think Kitchen Dwellers as a whole is a lot like that as a band. You know, when we're playing live, going back to the fact that none of us are trained musicians, but there's definitely an energy there that's palpable.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you can feel it. And I wouldn't even begin to guess which ones are recorded off the floor and which ones took a little more time, because the album really does have a great energy. Let's dig in a bit. And I know that you didn't write all the songs on the record, but hopefully you can add some commentary on the ones that we are going to discuss. Totally. And you can let us know if you did indeed write that song or not. The second track on the album is Broken Cage. And it's this jaunty song, traditional, very traditional in terms of instrumentation. And it spins a cowboy tale of life on the trail. You're not cowboys, but you can certainly relate, I'm sure, to this idea of being on the trail.
Torin actually wrote that song, and he actually was raised on a ranch in Montana.
Oh, wow.
So he's kind of a cowboy. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's fine. That's good. So he was raised, but certainly you have your collective experience of not being cowboys, but being on the trail and you know, life on the trail. How much of that, even though it doesn't speak directly to the lyrics of the song, how much of that does add influence into what you're talking about in that song?
Well, I know he wrote that coming from a place on a day where he wasn't exactly having the best day. And he actually wrote it when we were recording Ghost in the Bottle. And it was one of those days, I think, for him. And I won't say this because I've heard it come right out of his mouth before. But, you know, where he was just starting to question, like, what the hell are we doing out here? You know, he's looking at social media and everyone else our age is, you know, got a job, stable job somewhere, family, wife, kids, whatever. For some reason that day, he kind of felt like we weren't living up to what we were supposed to be or something. So he kind of wrote this. That's kind of where the lyrics kind of talk about a lot of that, is talking about being away from home, kind of spinning your wheels, wondering what you should be doing instead. And it's just kind of, it's saying with, yeah, it's the point of view of almost a, you know, someone who's driving a herd up from Texas up to Montana or something, but it's all that cattle drive kind of lived within his mind. At the time we were definitely, I would call it a starving artist situation.
Right. It's interesting because you guys are on the road and, you know, that human connection, that being with one another and, being able to talk to one another is probably challenging because you're the only ones, you know, the four of you are the only ones that are together and you must miss real life. I mean, you have social media and you have fans who adore you, but having a larger band of human connection must be tough. And that's probably, I guess, where the comet comes from, right? Where it's about the challenges of maintaining friendships back home because you guys are always on the run.
Yeah, that was the comment was written by Max, and in all honesty, he's never really talked too much about it. It's like origin. But what I do believe I hear that a lot is that Max actually left like a really, you know, high paying job working as a director for a ski school at a private ski area to end up doing this. So I think, that song came out, it was just kind of just a commentary on the battle on how hard you end up working at this and how long it takes to really pay off. But perseverance is key in most things in life. Perseverance and patience, I think, pay off. And then in touching back on the missing real life and stuff, we find that each band member has, you know, a strong passion or hobby or other things that they're into when we go home. You know, it's important to keep it all balanced, I think. You know, I like to spend a lot of my time outside in the mountains when I'm back in Montana, and everybody's into, whether it be hunting or fishing or hiking, mountain biking, that kind of stuff is definitely something that keeps us sane. You know, we spend none of us are really city dwellers and have lived in cities very much in our life, so when we go home, that's our real life to return to.
It's great that you mentioned Montana, and I know the band has obvious roots there, and Phaedrus makes a ton of sense given that it is from that road trip classic Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, and it's written by Montana State University professor Robert Persing. So talk about Phaedrus and this idea again of being on the road, and that's why that is another song that makes total sense for this record.
Yeah, you know, that's another Max one, actually. And I think, you know, that's just exactly that. It's a commentary of life on the road. And as you know, that Phaedrus is the ghost that follows our main character throughout the storyline on his trip. But I think that Max is writing about the idea of it's kind of just the ghost of what another life could be like, that it does follow you on the road, that you do feel it gets plays into your head a little bit, you know. And I think a lot of musicians could definitely resonate with that fact.
I don't have a list of who wrote what, but what song specifically did you write for this record? And can you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, I wrote Shadows, Woods Lake, and gosh, why is my brain Covered Bridges? Sorry.
Right.
So Shadows is a song that I wrote. You know, we travel the country all the time, and you basically see what the population lives like in everywhere you go. And I started to realize that there's like a pretty obvious opioid epidemic going on in our nation. I think definitely finally starting to get some news coverage, and you can certain places in our country, you can actually just walk down the street and see it. It's destruction wreaking havoc. So Shadows is a song. It's a fictional song about people who are in three different people who are in struggle, three different struggles related to that aspect.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of a call to maybe open eyes, or it's really just a way for me to express my own emotion on witnessing it. But it's just horrible.
Do you want to talk about the other two? Covered Bridges?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Sorry.
Covered Bridges is a little bit more on the softer, simpler edges side of things, I think that I wrote about. Covered Bridges is a breakup song, inspired by the woods of New England. it's basically a love lost and my reaction to that point, and everything's fine. She's a great friend of mine now. But it's just kind of one of those songs that was an emotional vomiting onto the page upon being dumped.
Yeah.
And the melody came out real, real nice, and Torin kind of came over, and I was all wallowing in sorrow. I was like, check this out. And he was like, you better cheer up, dude. He's like, that's the best melody you've ever written. And so we kept that around and turned that into a song. And that's Covered Bridges is actually the longest song on the album, I think. And that is a song that was definitely done in one take, which is pretty interesting.
I guess all that emotion, right? It's hard to capture that time and time again.
Yeah, and it's funny to look at songs like that, to where at a time when you wrote it, you felt something so strongly, but as time goes by, we obviously feel less or more strongly towards different things. And it's almost like this pain that I felt when I wrote that song is no longer there, and it almost makes the song feel like it's entirely about something else, which is, I think a lot of my lyrics work that way, and mm-hmm. there a lot of them are open to interpretation on what people want them to be about, which I like.
Yeah.
And it also allows them to evolve for myself as time goes on. It keeps them timeless for me. It keeps them relevant.
You mentioned that Covered Bridges is the longest song on the album. I would imagine that live, all of these songs kind of come out to play and aren't necessarily the way they are on the record. I mean, they are short, and most bluegrass or newgrass or however you want to describe it, you guys are writing shorter songs so that you can perform them either to their length appropriately from record or extend them in a live setting. Is that something that you guys are all conscious of?
We definitely like to do a fair amount of improvisation and stretching out of songs during our live shows, and we try to add a little bit of that into the album, but not so much. We like to keep it so, as you know, the album is a representation of the songs themselves, where a live show is the performance is a whole nother nature,
right?
So that's kind of we kind of realize it's cool. It's cool to showcase the actual ness or whatever to the song on the album, whereas live you can do whatever you want.
Probably my favorite song on the record, and not because it's an instrumental, just because I really dig it, is The Living Dread. It's a song with no lyrics at all, but I think it really does show all of your musicianship individually, but also as a band, and probably does encapsulate what the Kitchen Dwellers are all about. Do I have that right?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, I think that's a pretty good thing. The Living Dread is like a reggae, bluegrass, metal, dub dance hall psychedelic. It's pretty much got everything. There's literally a little structure part in that song that includes almost all of the genres that we cover, and I really like that. It just kind of it moves along, and we definitely, there's a tradition in acoustic music to play, instrumental songs, non-lyrical folk tunes, and that's just kind of our take on how Kitchen Dwellers creates that. Obviously, it's much different than something that somebody created in the woods in North Carolina 50 years ago would be, but it's, in a way, it's in the same vein and an homage. A lot of people may disagree with me, but it is acoustic instruments playing instrumental music, but it is, sounds like it comes from outer space.
Yeah, it totally does. Well, the band, given all of your different influences, and all the things that you listen to, it certainly makes sense, right? That all of those influences somehow make their way onto a record. And if you can't do it lyrically, then why not do it in an instrumental way?
Yeah, we like that. We had a similar one on our last album, Ebenezer's Winter, where I took a bluegrass song and turned it more metal. So I imagine we will, continue to explore further with that kind of songwriting style.
It's so interesting to me that there are so many bands in this bluegrass, newgrass genre that have a love of metal music, whether it's you guys or even Green Sky mentioned it last time I talked to them. Billy Strings is always talking about his metal influence. Is that because of the playing in metal music and just how good those musicians are, whether they're, guitar players or drummers or bass players? I mean, is it about the musicianship in metal?
I think that it has to do with that for sure, because I know that all musicians definitely acknowledge how gnarly those guys can play. I think a lot of it really has to do with all the music that everybody listens to when they're a teenager. And I think there's just a common trend of people who get into bluegrass. Bluegrass is becoming pretty popular now, but for a while, like 10 years ago, if you were into bluegrass or something, you were a counterculture type person. You're most possibly like a festival hippie. And a lot of those festival hippies kids were like metal kids in high school. Definitely, I think a lot of it stems from an outcast society. Mm-hmm. That's just my personal opinion, but at least in a lot of the way it worked for me. But I think it's in the counterculture element for sure.
Right, and that's why probably you guys fit in not only in the bluegrass community, but in the larger jam band community, because you are sort of outcasts and you are sort of away from the mainstream of whatever country music is now, or whatever traditional music is.
Whatever our songs sound like, we're not trying to be anybody else. Or, we are, at times we're like, hey, this song we would like to sound a little bit more like this or whatever. But we're definitely not out there trying to write any songs that sound like anybody else's songs. So just we're writing whatever we come out with, and that's the Kitchen Dwellers sound, I believe.
When is the Kitchen Dwellers, though, going to put together a full metal record? I mean, you need a drummer first, obviously, but...
that might be a whole other side project. I think I'm too into bluegrass in my heart to actually want to ever do that.
Right.
We'll see.
You guys are always on the road. I mean, you are in North Carolina, I think right now, in fact.
I am in Asheville currently.
Yeah, and you're playing the Peel. There are a whole bunch of dates, and are there places that you haven't been to yet that you're most excited to go to? Are there, I know that you're playing Jam Cruise at the beginning of the new year, and you're playing Snowstock. Are there festivals that you're psyched about? What's the mood like for you guys as you release this record?
None of the festivals are announced yet, but I can say there's going to be some pretty exciting ones this summer that are happening. I'm definitely currently looking forward to it. Even just later this week, playing the Orange Peel in Asheville is obviously a pretty legendary spot. Mm-hmm. Jam Cruise. I'm really looking forward to actually our New Year's Eve performance in Salt Lake. We're taking to the Commonwealth Room in Salt Lake City and doing the most ridiculous absurd theme we could think of, which is Twisted Sister Wives comedy. Just commentating on ridiculousness of 80s and Orthodox Mormon culture that barely exists anymore in Utah. It's just, you know, it's all funny and so far that people are responding to that pretty well.
Yeah.
We've got a pretty cool winter tour lined up. We're excited to announce a lot of dates. A lot of that stuff I just can't talk too much on yet.
No. Some of the dates that I mentioned are on the website. So I would imagine that some of it is public, like, you know, Snowstock in Colorado.
Snowstock is, yep, and that's really cool. We've had a great, we've been really close friends with the Magic Beans for, like, we've known those guys for like 10 years.
Right.
And, Snowstock is actually Scott from the Magic Beans' 30th birthday, so that'll be a pretty fun time. But Jam Cruise is probably, one of the more unique and surprising opportunities to arise for this band this year or in this coming year.
Yeah,
I don't think any of us have ever done anything like that.
Do you think, too, that there will be an opportunity for you guys to sit in or perform with other bands on the cruise? I mean, is that what you're excited about? Not just being there and being on the bill as, you know, this bluegrass band that could, but also being able to play with probably some heroes and some people that you want to check out, right?
Yeah, I mean, you hope so. I think that's the whole idea, kind of why they do it. It seems to be a lot of collaboration that happens every year, and I'm looking forward to seeing what I can get myself into. I like to keep myself pretty busy with playing when we're at those festivals. It will be different than it's not like we're playing at a festival with tons of bluegrass bands that we know.
Right.
We do know a lot of the artists on there, but I'm just interested to see what people will want to do collaboratively with us. You know, I think there'll be a lot of really unique and interesting opportunities to arise.
Well, continued success, dude. And that goes for the whole band, not just you. We've had Max and Torin on the show before, and we were excited about the new record. And well, our expectations were certainly met. It's a beautiful record, one that I encourage people to listen
to. Thank you so much.
And continued success, and have fun on the road. I know it can be a lonely place, but try to have some fun and enjoy. All right.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate all that, and it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Lots of juicy nuggets there from Sean about not only the new record Muir made, but lots of great anecdotes about working with Chris Pandolfi, writing music, and performing live. Before we leave you, have a listen to another track off of Muir Made. Here is Broken Cage.
Thank you. pretty painted ladies. Climb up on your knee and they'll ask for every story to make you forget about the bloodshed and the glory.
You've been listening to The Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. For more, visit thesoundpodcast.com.